This morning.
Thanks very much, Hugh. I've really enjoyed my time here, and I don't need to talk to you guys about systems. Boy, you're great system thinkers around a party. It's fantastic, fantastic evening, and you're prepared to take risk. That's really healthy, and this is an incredibly dry topic to launch into after such a good night. But thanks very much for your hospitality and your fine cheer. It was just fantastic to see. So I think we all know the setting in which we operate. We operate in an imperfect world, an imperfect system. And I'm just going to quote you a little bit of data from Australia. I don't think corresponding data exists from New Zealand. This was the first and only study done through Australia which directly looked at error during healthcare. And they retrospectively looked at 14,000 admissions to 28 hospitals and detected really an unacceptable level of medical error or error leading to adverse events with something of the order of 16.6% of admissions associated with an adverse event. And significant disability and mortality resulted from those events, and preventable healthcare-associated infection was a common mode of injury. More recently, last year, the Australian Commission on Safety and Quality in Healthcare in Australia published this review, which I've made a little link for you there. It's quite an extensive review of the role of surveillance, but as part of this, there's a chapter scoping the breadth and significance of healthcare-associated infection, and it does some estimates there that really are very similar to the earlier study, estimating close to 180,000 infection cases triggered by healthcare and close to 2 million bed days lost because of healthcare-associated infections. So this is all the hidden work that hidden stuff that goes on. Administrators don't know about it because most of it's not put in front of their faces, and it's part of the woodwork. Mortality, very difficult to estimate because it's not recorded properly, but we estimate close to 5,000 deaths per annum. And this is a slide you've probably seen from Dr. Lucien Leap at the National Patient Safety Network in the USA, comparing the risk of healthcare versus a few other common things or less common things that people do. So being in New Zealand, bungee jumping's there, and This rates things by the number of encounters for each fatality versus the total lives lost per year. And healthcare in the USA, at least, and probably in Australia, also is in that sector. Very large number of encounters occurring and an unacceptable level of risk. So next time your mother needs to go into hospital, you should offer her to go bungee jumping instead, or maybe on a chartered flight or something. But I think we've got a long way to go, because when we look at, say, the airline industry or the nuclear power industry, we are dealing with organisations that have really attended to risk in a manner that makes them resilient, so that they're able to tolerate error and have stops in place to prevent error causing adverse events. And I'm just going to talk through a bit of that conundrum. What about our healthcare staff? Mentioned patients, but I think healthcare staff are increasingly at risk. We know of blood-borne virus infection risks, but SARS brought us the scope of people in the developed world developing serious illness, and one in five cases of SARS were in healthcare workers with significant mortality. Influenza, respiratory syncytial virus, so paediatric staff can get RSV infection that can be severe. It's amazing how nonchalant they are, aren't they? The paediatricians and paediatric nurses believe that they're immune to all the viruses that the kids are transmitting. And, you know, they almost wear their immunity with pride sometimes when they talk to you. But certainly they can come a cropper. Tuberculosis, particularly in high endemicity countries. MRSA, increasingly with these community strains of MRSA, they don't favour patients over healthcare staff, and there's a large review of healthcare associated MRSA and healthcare staff, showing that 5% of healthcare staff were MRSA carriers and 1 in 20 of those had developed infections. And a more recent paper from the USA, they've got a strain there called USA 300, a Panton Valentine leukocidin positive strain that causes very significant skin and soft tissue infection, and there 16 of 45 clinic staff had had skin infections and one of those had died. So these are very significant risks, and it might help us to focus the attention of healthcare workers on our safe practices, mightn't it? I think people are more prepared to protect themselves than protect patients at the moment. Of course we should be protecting our patients, but a lot of what we do in standard precautions aims to protect us as well, and I think this is an angle we can take to our healthcare staff. Mr. James Reason from Britain is a fabulous thinker in the area of error. I'd really commend his books and papers. This is stuff taken out of a BMJ paper in 2000. I've got the reference at the end. And he speaks of three different models of error, basically a person model, in which we regard error as the product of wayward mental processes. You know, we're distracted, we're careless, and if we were very mindful, these errors wouldn't occur. And so in order to prevent error, we should take remedial measures against the people that are making error, you know, and make them feel bad for lapsing into error. And then he's got a legal or moral model, which is basically that if we're a responsible professional, we shouldn't make errors. You know, it's our duty of care. We won't make error. If we're a good person, we don't make error. If we're a bad person, we make error. And the concept here is that error is quite rare, but usually error is sufficient to cause adverse events. And so, again, this is focusing the blame for error down onto the personal level, the individual level. The last model, which he regards as the correct way to look at error, is that errors are commonplace. Basically, to err is human. It's part of our natural mental process. There's a positive balance in our mental process which leads to action and good things, and the debit side is that we occasionally lapse into error, and those errors are unavoidable. And that error only occasionally causes adverse events. So there are studies of surgeons working in operating theatres that indicate that even quite experienced surgeons make lots of errors, minor lapses through procedures, and that only a very small minority of those errors lead to adverse events. Most times those errors are detected by alert staff or the surgeon themselves, and corrective action has taken place. This is part of having a resilient system that is able to capture those errors and prevent them from creating trouble. And his concept here is that the sharp enders, the people who are, they're the inheritors of system problems rather than the actual instigators of error. Oh, they make the error, but they're making it in the setting of a system that's made error more likely to occur. And we'll just talk about this, how a product of many causal factors go together to make an adverse event. And our remedial efforts are therefore designed to remove these error traps, it might be removing a syringe that can be connected to a lumbar puncture needle and allowing a drug to be injected into the CSF, or it might be a particular time of day where the staff are overtired because they're at handover, and error is more likely to occur at that time of day, because all sorts of things like that. You'll know that quote of Don Berwick, which I love: each system is perfectly designed to get the results it achieves. So our system currently harms patients. It's designed to harm patients because we haven't thought it through. We haven't worked through all the necessary angles in that system. So this is his Swiss cheese model. You've all seen this, I'm sure, that basically an accident occurs through an alignment of defects within a lot of barriers along the way, and these defensive layers are in good systems have been engineered or they're people dependent. There might be procedures, there might be administrative controls, and by chance there are defects in these barriers that align and allow a sequence of things to lead to an adverse event. Now, two basic concepts here, active failures and latent conditions. So the active failures are the unsafe acts committed by people in direct contact with the patient or system. So these are the errors, the slips, lapses, mistakes, procedural violations, and these are hard to foresee or prevent because basically they may occur at different times. They tend to be trapped in particular locations within the system, so they're more likely to occur at certain times of day or in certain circumstances, but difficult to foresee or predict, and so it's very difficult to forestall them. Whereas latent conditions are the resident pathogens in the system, and they arise really from top-level decisions about how the system's designed, the builders, the procedure writers, the top-level management. And these latent conditions either provoke conditions that increase error, and he's much more able to explain this than I can, but or they create long-lasting holes or weaknesses in the defence that you can identify and remediate against. So that's part of the function of reporting error and near misses, is to identify those latent conditions that make error more likely to occur, and to tend to those before an adverse event occurs. So it's, in a safe culture, it's very important to have that reporting without fear and transparency of those reports, so that that you can make your system hardier. And this is a lovely quote from him: active failures are like mosquitoes. They can be swatted one by one, but they still keep coming. The best remedies are to create more effective defences and to drain the swamps in which they breed. It's just a wonderful way of expressing. And here's another quote: we cannot change the human condition, but we can change the conditions under which humans work. I think this is really worth thinking about in all our ways in which we work with people, because a lot of what we're doing, I think, is around improving our workforce and working with them in a way that doesn't counter their natural human ability to make error, because that's part of what they are and part of what makes humans fantastic. There's pluses and minuses. And he talks of a just culture. So, of course, we can't really have a no-blame culture. It's not feasible, it's not really desirable to have a no-blame culture, because there are culpable acts, things like sabotage or substance abuse. And we've got to have a system in place that, and a just culture is a system that you've got in place where the workforce has trust in management, and the workforce understands and agrees the difference between acceptable and unacceptable behaviour. And he reasons further that in looking at a potential culpable action, there are four different tests that can be done against those actions to determine whether they're culpable or not. And it's quite an explicit process to go through. One is a test of intentionality. Was the unsafe act intentional? Another was it caused through incapacity or ill health of the person? And those, in a sense, need their own remediations. There's a foresight test, which basically involves the idea that if the person was supposed to be following an agreed protocol or safe procedure, and the protocols were available, did the person take an unacceptable risk? So that might be a setting in which you might challenge someone about their hand hygiene performance, an habitual hand hygiene recidivist, perhaps. And then lastly, a substitution test. Would appear in the same situation, do the same thing, understanding that there were no mitigating circumstances. So there's quite hard-nosed ways of looking at behaviour and not accepting culpable acts. But in point of fact, when people study error and adverse events, it's only a very small proportion that are culpable. You might know of Mr. Patel in Queensland, the surgeon, much loved by the media, who's been pilloried, but and perhaps was and is thought to have been doing many unsafe acts, but he was able to do that within a system that hadn't detected that he wasn't properly qualified to be practicing in the area he was practicing in. So there were lots of system angles there that should have created barriers to his unsafe acts causing injury to patients. So our system approach has to limit dangerous areas and create systems that are better able to tolerate error and contain damaging effects. And when you look at those resilient organisations like the airline industry or the nuclear power industry or the military, an aircraft carrier, they're able to run for months and months and months at a time without a serious adverse event. And they do this through having very complex web interlocked organisational systems. And they're really multi-layered. They're involving people, the team, the task, the workplace, and the institution as a whole, the organisation as a whole. So it's a complex thing, but really the knowledge is out there to create these resilient systems, and we should be learning from our colleagues and industry. I don't take the point of view that the airline industry can't teach us anything. I think there are a lot of angles in which we just ride by the seats of our pants. So again, Lucien Leap, it's not just about reporting protocols, safe practices, it's about working together in multidisciplinary teams with mutual respect. So again, the team angle, which has been a really good theme of this this conference, I think, the way in which we function as a team together professionally as well as with our colleagues to achieve our ends, which we're all in agreement on. So what I've done now is a bit of a scorecard of latent conditions in the system that in Australia at least that affect healthcare risk, and I've gone through five different areas. I've made a subjective assessment of risk based on the likelihood and the severity of outcome. So this is using a scale that's derived from New South Wales Health. This is personnel management. These will be music to your ears. We know in infection control training we don't have consistent undergraduate training through health sciences. I think this is a major, major thing that we should be attending to wherever we can. We need to organise health science tertiary courses so that they get this similar training and that people are credentialed against key practices like hand hygiene, so that when a nurse or a doctor start up work, that we don't have to train them. We just have to assess them, maybe, and they've already been credentialed. We have systems which allow staff to get on board without being trained. You know those registrars who sneak into the place, the interns we capture, but often it's the registrars or the consultants, probably the most important things to capture, people to capture, we miss. Staff unaware of infection control precautions, infection control requirements not integrated into other training. So, you know, it might be a skills lab that's teaching how to put in whatever, and they're not attending to hand hygiene during that skills training. I think credentialing of invasive procedures has to be a must. Even a cannula can cause death, and deficient asepsis causes that. This is a bugbear, obviously, so I'm really preaching to the converted here, but I think all of these systems are poorly developed in most healthcare settings, in Australia at least. Clinical care, so standard and additional precautions, how well are they followed, and what risk does that entail to patients? We think it's quite considerable. Antibiotic stewardship, very poorly developed, and I think an enormous area in which we can improve outcomes through better stewardship. Immunisation of patients. Are we getting to those high-risk patients to protect them against influenza, pneumococcal infection, etc.? Infectious disease management. environmental systems. So we've heard a lot about environmental cleaning and disinfection, and really I think this is too variable, too left open to untrained staff who may not realise the importance of a particular near-patient environment. The built environment, our ability to clean environments really depend on maintenance of those environments and also their physical structure. We need isolation facilities. So we, in other senses, water, ventilation, waste, and food get a lot of talk, but really in terms of risk, I think they're low in terms of causing risk for patients or healthcare staff. Quality systems. Now, I work 50% of the time in the lab where we're under a very rigid ISO quality standard, and it's like, and then I walk out into the clinical arena and it's like being schizophrenic, because you go from a situation where to issue any document in the laboratory, it's got to have a number, it's got to be signed off, you've got to withdraw the previous document, it's got to go on the document management system. This is even things that are on the wall, for heaven's sake. And we all sort of bridle about that, but it really then makes certain that anything you find around in the lab is actually up to date and it has been through a review process. Now, if we go into a clinical ward, I bet your life you can find an out-of-date textbook or what have you lying around there with no notion of where it's come from. You can go on the intranet, much beloved by the administrators because they can put large documents that no one's going to read. And generally, and our health service is just as much at fault, there's all sorts of out-of-date stuff on the intranet. Nobody's bothered to check and see that there's a process. There's all this leaky process of things getting onto the web. And so document control is something that I think creates high risk, because it means that we can't assure ourselves that people are following proper guidelines. It's not the full equation, but I think you get my drift. Communication. So when serious adverse events are analysed in hospital, communication is one of the highest problem areas in terms of causing risk to patients. So handover of a problem between teams over hours, clinician who doesn't know that a patient was under his care and wasn't there to review the patient, so the patient suffers an adverse event. Even aspects like where do you find the number for the person who's looking after the patient? Is the person who's up against on the computer against that patient actually the person that looking after that patient? That's something that doesn't get attended to. We've got an internal phone directory on the intranet that's completely ad hoc. Depends on the individual going in there and updating their details. There's all sorts of errors in there. Luckily, we as humans are very error-tolerant and able to bridge across these things. But when push comes to shove in an urgent situation, do we know the right person to call? Are we going to find that number quickly when we need it? So the Australian Commission on Safety and Quality in Healthcare have been very concerned about communication and have been looking at this from a systems angle. And they've come up with a tool called the ISBAR tool, which is basically a way of briefing or communicating to someone about a significant problem. And they're trying to get us all to use this tool in any clinical communication or communication to the managers. Basically, ISBAR stands for, there's an introduction, situation analysis, an assessment, and then recommendation. So you're actually stepping through a set of protocol there to make sure that you're actually providing a clear communication. And I think elements of this communication come across in our dealings with patients and how we communicate things to patients. We need to structure this in a much better way so that they're empowered by getting our communications and by our transparency with them. So I think I won't labour the point on some of these other things, but I think our quality systems bear a lot of improvement. Support services, not really a big area, so medications are seldom contaminated. Suppliers are usually accredited and give us good equipment and so on. And really, sterilisation, disinfection doesn't lead to great numbers of patient injuries. So just at the end, I went to Lucien Leep's institute and tried to update what his thinking was, and he had some nice thoughts about five transforming concepts, which are these, and this keyed in with my idea that we need to improve tertiary education, because I think it really is a key lever. So medical education, I think, should be health sciences education here, all people working in healthcare, and this emphasis on skills and behaviours and attitudes, and really getting people to understand the quality equations up front, almost from the kindergarten on. Finding joy and meaning in work. I don't have to say anything like that to you guys. But isn't it crucial that we do this in work? We spend so much of our time in the workplace, and we're lucky to work in workplaces where people matter. And so it's the people angle that makes all the difference, doesn't it? And I'm preaching to the converted, but I think it's interesting that these guys are also coming down that line. Engaging consumers. So I think this is a very, very big area. There's a wonderful book called Better, which you've probably seen, by Atul Gawande. There's a chapter in there about cystic fibrosis care and about how a particular unit starts to involve the parents and families of these kiddies that are not doing as well in their unit as other units. They've benchmarked their unit, and it talks through the process of how what a transformational process it is for the parents and families to start to be involved in the care, directly in the care of their children, and how it has a positive impact on the outcome of those kids. So I think we really could take that element into a lot of our work in healthcare. Transparency. So I think we all know about open disclosure and its effect, that if an error occurs, an adverse event, we're far less likely to be taken to court if we've been upfront and open with the discussion with the family and admitting what has happened and what is going to take place, being transparent. And I think that's... I don't know if that's happened in New Zealand, but there's been a very big process in Australia around open disclosure and transparent decision-making around medical error. And I think that's really helped us a lot to understand and to encourage reporting of error. Integration of care. So this is a big flavour that I think is happening around the world. Just at the end, I'll just mention this National Safety and Quality Framework, which is released for review. It's a very nice encapsulated look at safety and quality in healthcare and the sort of things that need to happen. It's been very well designed, and there are companion accreditation standards that will eventually replace the relevant EQIP standards, and there's going to be a new accreditation process in Australia which will be much more hard-nosed than EQIP, I think. It will be around determining compliance against the standard. It won't be like a quality improvement process the way EQIP is. It will be more like an assessment visit, and you either comply or you don't, and there's certain elements in that assessment that will be crucial. It'll be a weighted assessment, but if you don't pass on certain things, then you don't pass, and the shit hits the fan. So these standards are around governance and healthcare-associated infection, medication safety, and patient identification and procedure matching. And the healthcare standard looks at these areas: systems and governance, infection prevention policies and protocols, managing patients with infection, stewardship, cleaning, etc., and consumer information. So I think that this is going to be... It's been really well discussed, well referenced, and thought through, and... It may be something that New Zealand wants to look at. So that's all I've got to say. Thanks for listening, and I hope it wasn't too dry after such a wonderful party. Thanks very much.